This is Audible.
Penguin Audio presents The Invention of Wings by Sue Monk Kidd. Read by Jenna Lamia and Adepero Oduye.
Part 1, November 1803 to February 1805. Hetty Handful Grimke. There was a time in Africa the people could fly. Mama told me this one night when I was 10 years old. She said, "Handful, your granny mama saw it for herself. She said they flew over trees and clouds. She said they flew like blackbirds. When we came here, we left that magic behind." My mama was shrewd. She didn't get any reading and writing like me. Everything she knew came from living on the scarce side of mercy. She looked at my face, how it flowed with sorrow and doubt, and she said, "You don't believe me? Where you think these shoulder blades of yours come from, girl?" Those skinny bones stuck out from my back like nubs. She patted them and said, "This all what left of your wings. They nothing but these flat bones now, but one day you gonna get them back." I was shrewd like mama. Even at 10, I knew this story about people flying was pure malarkey. We weren't some special people who lost our magic. We were slave people, and we weren't going anywhere. It was later I saw what she meant. We could fly all right, but it wasn't any magic to it. The day life turned into nothing this world could fix. I was in the workyard boiling slave bedding, stoking fire under the wash pot, my eyes burning from specks of lye soap catching on the wind. The morning was a cold one. The sun looked like a little white button stitched tight to the sky. For summers, we wore homespun cotton dresses over our drawers. But when the Charleston winter showed up like some lazy girl in November or January, we got into our sacks. These thick-set coats made of heavy yarns. Just an old sack with sleeves. Mine was a cast-off and trailed to my ankles. I couldn't say how many unwashed bodies had worn it before me, but they had all kindly left their scents on it. Already that morning, Mrs. had taken her cane stick to me once across my backside for falling asleep during her devotions. Every day, all us slaves, everyone but Rosetta, who was old and demented, jammed in the dining room before breakfast to fight off sleep while Mrs. taught us short Bible verses like Jesus wept and prayed out loud about God's favorite subject, obedience. If you nodded off, you got whacked right in the middle of "God said this and God said that." I was full of sass to Aunt Sister about the whole miserable business. I'd say, "Let this cup pass from me," spouting one of Mrs. verses. I'd say, "Jesus wept 'cause he's trapped in there with Mrs. like us." Aunt Sister was the cook. She'd been with Mrs. since Mrs. was a girl. And next to Tomfrey, the butler, she ran the whole show. She was the only one who could tell Mrs. what to do without getting smacked by the cane. Mama said, "Watch your tongue." But I never did. Aunt Sister popped me backward 3 times a day. I was a handful. That's not how I got my name, though. Handful was my basket name. The master and missus, they did all the proper naming, but a mama would look on her baby, laid in its basket, and a name would come to her. Something about what her baby looked like, what day of the week it was, what the weather was doing, or just how the world seemed on that day. My mama's basket name was Summer, but her proper name was Charlotte. She had a brother whose basket name was Hard Time. People think I make that up, but it's true as it can be. If you got a basket name, you at least had something from your mama. Master Grimke named me Hetty. But mama looked at me on the day I came into the world, how I was born too soon, and she called me Handful. That day, while I helped our Aunt Sister in the yard, mama was in the house, working on a gold sateen dress for Mrs. with a bustle on the back, what's called a Watteau gown. She was the best seamstress in Charleston and worked her fingers stiff with the needle. You never saw such finery as my mama could whip up, and she didn't use a stamping pattern. She hated a book pattern. She picked out the silks and velvets her own self at the market and made everything the Grimkes had. Window curtains, quilted petticoats, looped panniers, buckskin pants, and these done-up jockey outfits for race week. I can tell you this much. White people lived for race week. They had one picnic, promenade, and fancy going on after another. Mrs. King's party was always on Tuesday, the jockey club dinner on Wednesday. The big fuss came Saturday with the St. Cecilia ball when they strutted out in their best dresses. Aunt Sister said Charleston had a case of the Granges. Up till I was 8 or so, I thought the Granges was a shitting sickness. Mrs. was a short, thick-waist woman with what looked like little balls of dough under her eyes. She refused to hire out Mama to the other ladies. They begged her, and Mama begged her too, 'cause she would have kept a portion of those wages for herself. But Mrs. said, "I can't have you make anything for them better than you make for us." In the evenings, Mama tore strips for her quilts, while I held the tallow candle with one hand and stacked the strips in piles with the other, always by color, neat as a pin. She liked her colors bright. Putting shades together, nobody would think. Purple and orange, pink and red. The shape she loved was a triangle. Always black. Mama put black triangles on about every quilt she sewed. We had a wooden patch box for keeping our scraps, a pouch for our needles and threads, and a true brass thimble. Mama said the thimble would be mine one day. But she wasn't using it, I wore it on my fingertip like a jewel. We filled our quilts up with raw cotton and wool thrums. The best filling was feathers, still is, and Mama and I never passed one on the ground without picking it up. Some days, Mama would come in with a pocket full of goose feathers she'd plucked from mattress holes in the house. When we got desperate to fill a quilt, we'd strip the long moss from the oak in the work yard and sew it between the lining and the quilt top, chiggers and all. That was the thing Mama and I loved, our time with the quilts. No matter what Aunt Sister had me doing in the yard, I always watched the upstairs window where Mama did her stitching. We had a signal. When I turned the pail upside down by the kitchen house, that meant everything was clear. Mama would open the window and throw down a taffy she stole from Mrs. Room. Sometimes here came a bundle of cloth scraps. Real nice calicoes, gingham, muslin, some import linen. One time, that true brass thimble. Her favorite thing to take was scarlet red thread. She would wind it up in her pocket and walk right out the house with it. The yard was overbusy that day, so I didn't have hope for a taffy falling from the clear blue. Mariah, the laundry slave, had burned her hand on charcoal from the iron and was laid up. Aunt Sister was on a tear about the backed up wash. Tomfrey had the men fixing to butcher a hog that was running and screeching at the top of its lungs. Everyone was out there. From old Snow, the carriage driver, all the way down to the stable mucker, Prince. Tomfrey wanted to get the killing over quick because Mrs. hated yard noise. Noise was on her list of slave sins, which we knew by heart. 1, stealing. 2, disobedience. 3, laziness. 4, noise. A slave was supposed to be like the Holy Ghost. Don't see it, don't hear it, but it's always hovering round on ready. Mrs. called out to Tomfrey, said, "Keep it down. A lady shouldn't know where her bacon comes from." When we heard that, I told Aunt Sister Mrs. didn't know what end her bacon went in and what end it came out. Aunt Sister slapped me into yesterday. I took the long pole we called the battling stick and fished up the bed covers from the wash pot and flopped them dripping on the rail where Aunt Sister dried her cooking herbs. The rail in the stable was forbidden because the horses had eyes too precious for lie. Slave eyes were another thing. Working the stick, I beat those sheets and blankets to an inch of their lives. We called it fetching the dirt. After I got the wash finished, I was left idle and pleased to enjoy sin 3. I followed a path I'd worn in the dirt from looping it 10-12 times a day. I started at the back of the main house, walked past the kitchen house and the laundry, out to the spreading tree. Some of the branches on it were bigger round than my body, and every one of them curled like ribbons in a box. Bad spirits traveled in straight lines, and our tree didn't have one uncrooked place. Us slaves mustered under it when the heat bore down. Mama always told me, don't pull the gray moss off, 'cause that keeps out the sun and everybody's prying eyes. I walked back past the stable and carriage house. The path took me across the whole map of the world I knew. I hadn't yet seen the spinning globe in the house that showed the rest of it. I poked along, wishing for the day to get used up so me and Mama could go to our room. It sat over the carriage house and didn't have a window. The smell of manure from the stable and the cowhouse rose up there so ripe, it seemed like our bed was stuffed with it instead of straw. The rest of the slaves had their rooms over the kitchen house. The wind whipped up and I listened for ship sails snapping in the harbor across the road, a place I'd smelled on the breeze, but never seen. The sails would go off like whips cracking, and all us would listen to see if it was some slave getting flogged in a neighbor yard, or was it ships making ready to leave. You found out when the screams started up or not. The sun had gone, leaving a puckered place in the clouds, like the button had fallen off. I picked up the battling stick by the wash pot and for no good reason jabbed it into a squash in the vegetable garden. I pitched the butternut over the wall where it splattered into a loud mess. Then the air turned still. Mrs. Voice came from the back door, said, "Aunt Sister, bring Hetty in here to me right now." I went to the house, thinking she was in an uproar over her squash. I told my backside to brace up.
Sarah Grimke. My 11th birthday began with Mother promoting me from the nursery. For a year, I'd longed to escape the porcelain dolls, tops, and tiny tea sets strewn across the floor. The small beds lined up in a row, the whole glut and bedlam of the place. But now that the day had come, I balked at the threshold of my new room. It was paneled with darkness and emanated the smell of my brother, all things smoky and leather. The oak canopy and red velvet valance of the bedstead was so towering, it seemed closer to the ceiling than the floor. I couldn't move for dread of living alone in such an enormous, overweening space. Drawing a breath, I flung myself across the doorsill. That was the artless way I navigated the hurdles of girlhood. Everyone thought I was a plucky girl, but in truth, I wasn't as fearless as everyone assumed. I had the temperament of a tortoise. Whatever dread, fright, or bump appeared in my path, I wanted nothing more than to drop in my tracks and hide. If you must err, do so on the side of audacity. That was the little slogan I had devised for myself. For some time now, it had helped me to hurl myself over door sills. That morning was full of cold, bright wind pouring off the Atlantic, and clouds blowing like windsocks. For a moment, I stood just inside the room, listening to the saber fronds on the palmettos clatter around the house. The eaves of the piazza hissed. The porch swing groaned on its chains. Downstairs in the warming kitchen, Mother had the slaves pulling out Chinese tureens and Wedgwood cups, preparing for my birthday party. Her maid Cindy had spent hours wetting and fastening Mother's wig with paper and curlers, and the sour smell of it baking had nosed all the way up the stairs. I watched as Binna, the nursery mama, tucked my clothes into the heavy old wardrobe, recalling how she used a fire poke to rock Charles's cradle, her cowrie shell bracelets rattling along her arms while she terrified us with tales of the Booga Hag, an old woman who rode about on a broom and sucked the breath from bad children.
I would miss Benna. And sweet Anna, who slept with her thumb in her mouth. Ben and Henry, who jumped like banshees until their mattresses erupted with geysers of goose feathers. And little Eliza, who had a habit of slipping into my bed to hide from the Booga's nightly reign of terror. Of course, I should have graduated from the nursery long ago, but I'd been forced to wait for John to go away to college. Our three-storied house was one of the grandest in Charleston, but it lacked enough bedrooms, considering how, well, fruitful Mother was. There were 10 of us. John, Thomas, Mary, Frederick, and myself, followed by the nursery dwellers, Anna, Eliza, Ben, Henry, and baby Charles. I was the middle one, the one Mother called different and Father called remarkable, the one with the carroty hair and the freckles, all constellations of them. My brothers had once traced Orion, the Dipper, and Ursa Major on my cheeks and forehead with charcoal, connecting the bright red specks. And I hadn't minded. I'd been their whole sky for hours. Everyone said I was Father's favorite. I don't know whether he preferred me or pitied me, but he was certainly my favorite. He was a judge on South Carolina's highest court, and at the top of the planter class, the group Charleston claimed as its elite. He'd fought with General Washington and been taken prisoner by the British. He was too modest to speak of these things. For that, he had Mother. Her name was Mary, and there ends any resemblance to the Mother of our Lord. She was descended from the first families of Charleston, that little company of lords that King Charles had sent over to establish the city. She worked this into conversation so tirelessly we no longer made the time or effort to roll our eyes. Besides governing the house, a host of children, and 14 slaves, she kept up a round of social and religious duties that would have worn out the queens and saints of Europe. When I was being forgiving, I said that my mother was simply exhausted. I suspected, though, she was simply mean. When Benna finished arranging my hair combs and ribbons on the lavish Heppelwhite atop my new dressing table, she turned to me, and I must have looked forsaken standing there, because she clucked her tongue against the roof of her mouth and said, "Poor Miss Sarah." I did so despise the attachment of poor to my name. Benna had been muttering "Poor Miss Sarah" like an incantation since I was 4. It's my earliest memory, arranging my brother's marbles into words. It is summer, and I am beneath the oak that stands in the back corner of the workyard. Thomas, 10, whom I love above all the others, has taught me 9 words. Sarah, girl, boy, go, stop, jump, run, up, down. He has written them on a parchment and given me a pouch of 48 glass marbles with which to spell them out, enough to shape 2 words at a time. I arrange the marbles in the dirt, copying Thomas's inked words. Sarah, go. Boy, run. Girl, jump. I work as fast as I can. Benna will come soon looking for me. It's Mother, however, who descends the back steps into the yard. Benna and the other house slaves are clumped behind her, moving with cautious, synchronized steps as if they're a single creature, a centipede crossing an unprotected space. I sense the shadow that hovers over them in the air, some devouring dread, and I crawl back into the green-black gloom of the tree. The slaves stare at Mother's back, which is straight and without give. She turns and admonishes them.
"You are lagging. Quickly now, let us be done with this."
As she speaks, an older slave, Rosetta, is dragged from the cowhouse, dragged by a man, a yard slave, she fights, clawing at his face. Mother watches, impassive. He ties Rosetta's hands to the corner column of the kitchen house porch. She looks over her shoulder and begs.
Mrs., please. Mrs., please.
She begs, even as the man lashes her with his whip. Her dress is cotton, a pale yellow color. I stare transfixed as the back of it sprouts blood. Blooms of red that open like petals. I cannot reconcile the savagery of the blows with the mellifluous way she keens, or the beauty of the roses coiling along the trellis of her spine. Someone counts the lashes. Is it Mother? 6, 7. The scourging continues, but Rosetta stops wailing and sinks against the porch rail. 9, 10. My eyes look away. They follow a black ant traveling the far reaches beneath the tree. The mountainous roots and forested mosses. The endless perils. And in my head I say the words I fashioned earlier. Boy, run. Girl, jump. Sarah, go. 13, 14. I bolt from the shadows, past the man who now coils his whip. Job well done. Past Rosetta hanging by her hands in a heap. As I bound up the back steps into the house, Mother calls to me, and Benna reaches to scoop me up, but I escape them, thrashing along the main passage, out the front door, where I break blindly for the wharves. I don't remember the rest with clarity, only that I find myself wandering across the gangplank of a sailing vessel, sobbing, stumbling over a turban of rope. A kind man with a beard and a dark cap asks what I want. I plead with him. Sarah, go. Benna chases me, though I'm unaware of her until she pulls me into her arms and coos. Poor Miss Sarah. Poor Miss Sarah. Like a decree, a proclamation, a prophecy. When I arrive home, I am a muss of snot, tears, yard dirt, and harbor filth. Mother holds me against her, rears back and gives me an incensed shake, then clasps me again.
You must promise never to run away again. Promise me.
I want to. I try to. The words are on my tongue, the rounded lumps of them, shining like the marbles beneath the tree.
Sarah!
She demands. Nothing comes. Not a sound. I remained mute for a week. My words seemed sucked into the cleft between my collarbones. I rescued them by degrees, by praying, bullying, and wooing. I came to speak again, but with an odd and mercurial form of stammer. I'd never been a fluid speaker. Even my first spoken words had possessed a certain belligerent quality. But now there were ugly, halting gaps between my sentences. Endless seconds when the words cowered against my lips, and people averted their eyes. Eventually, these horrid pauses began to come and go according to their own mysterious whims. They might plague me for weeks and then remain away months, only to return again as abruptly as they left. The day I moved from the nursery to commence a life of maturity in John's staid old room, I wasn't thinking of the cruelty that had taken place in the workyard when I was 4, or of the thin filaments that had kept me tethered to my voice ever since. Those concerns were the farthest thing from my mind. My speech impediment had been absent for some time now, 4 months and 6 days. I'd almost imagined myself cured. So when Mother swept into the room all of a sudden, me in a paroxysm of adjustment to my surroundings, and Benna tucking my possessions here and there, and asked if my new quarters were to my liking. I was stunned by my inability to answer her. The door slammed in my throat, and the silence hung there. Mother looked at me and sighed. When she left, I willed my eyes to remain dry and turned away from Binna. I couldn't bear to hear one more, "Poor Miss Sarah."
Handful. Aunt Sister took me to the warming kitchen where Benna and Cindy were fussing over silver trays, laying them full of ginger cake and apples with groundnuts. They had on their good long aprons with starch. Off in the drawing room, it sounded like bees buzzing. Mrs. showed up and told Aunt Sister to peel off my nasty coat and wash my face. Then she said, "Hetty, this is Sarah's 11th birthday, and we are having a party for her." She took a lavender ribbon from the top of the pie safe and circled it round my neck, tying a bow, while Aunt Sister peeled the black off my cheeks with her rag. Mrs. wound more ribbon round my waist. When I tugged, she told me in a sharp way, "Stop that fidgeting, Hetty. Be still." Mrs. had done the ribbon too snug at my throat. It felt like I couldn't swallow. I searched for Aunt Sister's eyes, but they were glued on the food trays. I wanted to tell her, "Get me free of this. Help me. I need the privy." I always had something smart to say, but my voice had run down my throat like a kitchen mouse. I danced on one leg and the other. I thought what Mama had told me, "You be good coming up on Christmas, 'cause that when they sell off the extra children, or else send them to the fields." I didn't know one slave Master Grimke had sold, but I knew plenty he'd sent to his plantation in the back country. That's where Mama had come from, bearing me inside her and leaving my daddy behind. I stopped on my fidget then. My whole self went down in the hole where my voice was. I tried to do what they said God wanted. Obey, be quiet, be still. Mrs. studied me, how I looked in the purple ribbons. Taking me by the arm, she led me to the drawing room where the ladies sat with their dresses fussed out and their china teacups and lacy napkins. One lady played the tiny piano called a harpsichord, but she stopped when Mrs. gave a clap with her hands. Every eye fixed on me. Mrs. said, "This is our little Hetty. Sarah, dear, she's your present, your very own waiting maid." I pressed my hands between my legs, and Mrs. knocked them away. She turned me a full circle. The ladies started up like parrots, "Happy birthday, happy birthday," their fancy heads pecking the air. Miss Sarah's older sister, Miss Mary, sat there full of sulk from not being the center of the party. Next to Mrs., she was the worst bird in the room. We'd all seen her going around with her waiting maid, Lucy, smacking the girl six ways from Sunday. We all said if Miss Mary dropped her kerchief from the second floor, she'd send Lucy jumping out the window for it. Least I didn't end up with that one. Miss Sarah stood up. She was wearing a dark blue dress and had rosy-colored hair that hung straight like corn silk and freckles the same red color all over her face. She took a long breath and started working her lips. Back then, Miss Sarah pulled words up from her throat like she was raising water from a well. When she finally got the bucket up, we could hardly hear what she was saying. "I'm sorry, Mother. I can't accept." Mrs. asked her to say it over. This time, Miss Sarah bellowed it like a shrimp peddler. Mrs. eyes were frost blue like Miss Sarah's, but they turned dark as indigo. Her fingernails bore into me and carved out what looked like a flock of birds on my arm. She said, "Sit down, Sarah dear." Miss Sarah said, I don't need a waiting maid. I'm perfectly fine without one." "That is quite enough," Mrs. said. How you can miss the warning in that, I don't know. Miss Sarah missed it by a mile. Couldn't you save her for Anna? Enough. Miss Sarah plopped on her chair like somebody shoved her. The water started in a trickle down my leg. I jerked every way I could to get free of Mrs. Claus, but then it came in a gush on the rug. Mrs. let out a shriek, and everything went hush. You could hear embers leap round in the fireplace. I had a slap coming, or worse. I thought of Rosetta, how she threw a shaking fit when it suited her. She'd let the spit run from her mouth and send her eyes rolling back. She looked like a beetle bug upside down trying to right itself, but it got her free of punishment, and it crossed my mind to fall down and pitch a fit myself the best I could. But I stood there, with my dress plastered wet on my thighs and shame running hot down my face. Aunt's sister came and toted me off. When we passed the stairs in the main hall, I saw Mama up on the landing, pressing her hands to her chest. That night, doves sat up in the tree limbs and moaned. I clung to Mama in our rope bed, staring at the quilt frame the way it hung over us from the ceiling rafters, drawn tight on its pulleys. She said the quilt frame was our guardian angel. She said, everything gonna be all right. But the shame stayed with me. I tasted it like a bitter green on my tongue. The bells tolled across Charleston for the slave curfew, and Mama said the guard would be out there soon beating on their drums. But she said it like this, bugs be in the wheat for long. Then she rubbed the flat bones in my shoulders. That's when she told me the story from Africa her Mama told her. How the people could fly. How they flew over trees and clouds. How they flew like blackbirds. Next morning, Mama handed me a quilt matched to my length and told me I couldn't sleep with her anymore. From here on out, I would sleep on the floor in the hall outside Miss Sarah's bedchamber. Mama said, don't get off your quilt for nothing but Miss Sarah calling. Don't wander about, don't light no candle, don't make noise. When Miss Sarah rings the bell, you make haste. Mama told me, it gonna be hard from here on, handful.
Sarah. I was sent to solitary confinement in my new room and ordered to write a letter of apology to each guest. Mother settled me at the desk with paper, inkwell, and a letter she'd composed herself, which I was to copy. You didn't punish Hetty, did you? I asked. Do you think me inhuman, Sarah? The girl had an accident. What could I do? She shrugged with exasperation. If the rug cannot be cleaned, it will have to be thrown out. As she walked to the door, I struggled to pry the words from my mouth before she exited. Mother, please, let me give Hetty back to you. Give Hetty back. As if she was mine after all. As if owning people was as natural as breathing. For all my resistance about slavery, I breathed that foul air too. Your guardianship is legal and binding. Hetty is yours, Sarah. There is nothing to be done about it. But I heard the commotion of her petticoats as she crossed the rug back to me. She was a woman the winds and tides obeyed. But in that moment, she was gentle with me. Placing a finger under my chin, she tilted my face to hers and smiled. Why must you fight this? I don't know where you get these alien ideas. This is our way of life, dear one. Make your peace with it. She kissed the top of my head. I expect all 18 letters by the morning. The room filled with an orange glow that lit the cypress panels, then melted into dusk and shadows. In my mind, I could see Hetty clearly. The confused, mortified look on her face. Her hair braids cocked in every direction. The disgraceful lavender ribbons. She was puny in the extreme. A year younger than I, but she looked all of 6 years old. Her limbs were stick and bone. Her elbows, the curves of two fastening pins. The only thing of any size about her was her eyes, which were colored a strange shade of gold and floated above her black cheeks like shiny half-moons. It seemed traitorous to ask forgiveness for something I didn't feel sorry for in the least. What I regretted was how pathetic my protest had turned out. I wanted nothing more than to sit here unyielding through the night, for days and weeks if need be. But in the end I gave in and wrote the damnable letters. I knew myself to be an odd girl with my mutinous ideas, ravenous intellect, and funny looks. And half the time I sputtered like a horse straining at its bit, qualities in the female sex that were not endearing. I was on my way to being the family pariah, and I feared the ostracism. I feared it most of all. Over and over I wrote, "Dear Madam, thank you for the honor and kindness you bestowed upon me by attending my 11th birthday tea. I regret that though I have been well taught by my parents, my behavior on this occasion was exceedingly ill-mannered. I humbly beg your pardon for my rudeness and disrespect. Your remorseful friend, Sarah Grimke." I climbed the preposterous height to the mattress, and had only just settled when a bird outside my window began to trill. First a stream of pelting whistles, then a soft, melancholic song. I felt alone in the world with my alien ideas. Sliding from my perch, I stole to the window where I shivered in my white woolen gown, gazing along East Bay, past the dark rooftops toward the harbor. With hurricane season behind us, there were close to 100 topsails moored out there, shimmering on the water. Plastering my cheek against the frigid pane, I discovered I had a partial view of the slave quarters above the carriage house, where I knew Hetty to be spending her last night with her mother. Tomorrow she would take up her duties and sleep outside my door. It was then I had a sudden epiphany. I lit a candle from the dwindling coals in the fire, opened my door, and stepped into the dark, unheated passageway. Three dark shapes lay on the floor beside the bedroom doors. I'd never really seen the world beyond the nursery at night, and it took a moment to realize the shapes were slaves, sleeping close by in case a Grimke rang his bell. Mother wished to replace the archaic arrangement with one that had recently been installed in the house of her friend, Mrs. Russell. There, buttons were pressed that rang in the slaves' quarters, each with a special chime. Mother was bent on the innovation, but Father thought it wasteful. Though we were Anglicans, he had a mild streak of Huguenot frugality. There would be ostentatious buttons in the Grimke household over his dead body. I crept barefooted down the wide mahogany stairs to the first floor, where two more slaves slept, along with Cindy, who sat wide awake with her back against the wall outside my parents' chamber. She eyed me warily, but didn't ask what I was doing. I picked my way along the Persian rug that ran the near length of the main passage, turned the knob to Father's library, and stepped inside. An ornately framed portrait of George Washington was lit with a scrim of moonlight coming through the front window. For almost a year, Father had looked the other way as I had slipped beneath Mr. Washington's nose to plunder the library. John, Thomas, and Frederick had total reign over his vast trove. Books of law, geography, philosophy, theology, history, botany, poetry, and the Greek humanities, while Mary and I were officially forbidden to read a word of it. Mary didn't seem to care for books, but I dreamed of them in my sleep. I loved them in a way I couldn't fully express, even to Thomas. He pointed me to certain volumes and drilled me on Latin declensions. He was the only one who knew my desperation to acquire a true education, beyond the one I received at the hands of Madame Ruffin, my tutor and French nemesis. She was a small, hot-tempered woman who wore a widow's cap with strings floating at her cheeks, and when it was cold, a squirrely fur cloak and tiny fur-lined shoes. She was known to line girls up on the idle bench for the smallest infraction and scream at them until they fainted. I despised her, and her polite education for the female mind, which was composed of needlework, manners, drawing, basic reading, penmanship, piano, Bible, French, and enough arithmetic to add two and two. I thought it possible I might die from tracing teensy flowers on the pages of my art tablet. Once I wrote in the margin, "If I should die of this horrid exercise, I wish these flowers to adorn my coffin." Madame Ruffin was not amused. I was made to stand on the idle bench, where she ranted at my insolence, and where I forced myself not to faint. Increasingly, during those classes, longings had seized me, foreign, torrential aches that overran my heart. I wanted to know things, to become someone. Oh, to be a son. I adored Father because he treated me almost as if I were a son, allowing me to slip in and out of his library. On that night, the coals in the library's fireplace lay cold, and the smell of cigar smoke still pooled in the air. Without effort, I located Father's South Carolina Justice of the Peace and Public Laws, which he himself had authored. I'd thumbed through it enough to know somewhere in the pages was a copy of a legal manumission document. Upon finding it, I took paper and quill from Father's desk and copied it. "I hereby certify that on this day, 26 November 1803, in the city of Charleston, in the state of South Carolina, I set free from slavery Hetty Grimke, and bestow this certificate of manumission upon her. Sarah Moore Grimke." What could Father do but make Hetty's freedom as legal and binding as her ownership? I was following a code of law he'd fashioned himself. I left my handiwork atop the backgammon box on his desk. In the corridor, I heard the tingle of Mother's bell, summoning Cindy, and I broke into a run back upstairs that blew out the flame on my candle. My room had turned even colder, and the little bird had ceased its song. I crept beneath the stack pile of quilts and blankets, but couldn't sleep for excitement. I imagined the Thanksgiving Hetty and Charlotte would heap on me. I imagined Father's pride when he discovered the document, and Mother's annoyance. Legal and binding indeed. Finally, overcome with fatigue and satisfaction, I drifted to sleep. When I woke, the bluish tint of the Delft tiles around the hearth gleamed with light. I sat up into the quietness. My ecstatic burst of the night before had drained away, leaving me calm and clear. I couldn't have explained then how the oak tree lives inside the acorn, or how I suddenly realized that in the same enigmatic way, something lived inside of me, the woman I would become. But it seemed I knew at once who she was. It had been there all along, as I'd scoured Father's books and constructed my arguments during our dinner table debates. Only the past week, Father had orchestrated a discussion between Thomas and me on the topic of exotic fossilized creatures. Thomas argued that if these strange animals were truly extinct, it implied poor planning on God's part, threatening the ideal of God's perfection. Therefore, such creatures must still be alive in remote places on Earth. I argued that even God should be allowed to change his mind. "Why should God's perfection be based on having an unchanging nature?" I asked. "Isn't flexibility more perfect than stasis?" Father slapped his hand on the table. "If Sarah was a boy, she would be the greatest jurist in South Carolina." At the time, I'd been awed by his words. But it wasn't until now, waking up in my new room, that I saw their true meaning. The comprehension of my destiny came in a rush. I would become a jurist. Naturally, I knew there were no female lawyers. For a woman, nothing existed but the domestic sphere and those tiny flowers etched on the pages of my art book. For a woman to aspire to be a lawyer? Well, possibly the world would end. But an acorn grew into an oak tree, didn't it? I told myself the affliction in my voice wouldn't stop me. It would compel me. It would make me strong, for I would have to be strong. I had a history of enacting small, private rituals. The first time I took a book from Father's library, I'd pen the date and title. February 25, 1803. Lady of the Lake. On a sliver of paper that I wedged into a tortoiseshell hair clip and wore about surreptitiously. Now, with dawn gathering in bright tufts across the bed, I wanted to consecrate what was surely my greatest realization. I went to the armoire and took down the blue dress Charlotte had sewed for the disastrous birthday party. Where the collar met, she'd stitched a large silver button with an engraved fleur-de-lis. Using the hawkbill letter opener John had left behind, I sawed it off. Squeezing it in my palm, I prayed. Please, God, let this seed you planted in me bear fruit. When I opened my eyes, everything was the same. The room still bore patches of early light. The dress lay like a blue heap of sky on the floor. The silver button was clutched in my palm. But I felt God had heard me. The sterling button took on everything that transpired that night. The revulsion of owning Hetty, the relief of signing her manumission, but mostly the bliss of recognizing that innate seed in myself, the one my father had already seen. A jurist. I tucked the button inside a small box made of Italian lava rock, which I'd received one Christmas time, then hid it at the back of my dressing drawer. Voices came from the corridor, mingled with the clink-clank of trays and pitchers, the sound of slaves in their servitude, the world waking. I dressed hurriedly, wondering if Hetty was already outside my door. As I opened it, my heart picked up its pace. But Hetty wasn't there. The manumission document I'd written lay on the floor. It was torn in two.
Handful. My life with Miss Sarah got off on a bad left foot. When I got to her room that first morning, the door hung open and Miss Sarah was sitting in the cold, staring at the blank wall. I stuck my head in and said, "Miss Sarah, you want me to come in there?" She had thick little hands with stubby fingers, and they went up to her mouth and spread open like a lady's fan. Her eyes were pale and spoke plainer than her mouth. They said, "I don't want you here." Her mouth said, "Yes, come in. I'm pleased to have you for my waiting maid." Then she slumped in her chair and went back to what she was doing before. Nothing. A 10-year-old yard slave who hadn't done nothing but chores for Aunt Sister never got inside the house much, and never to the top floors. What such a room! She had a bed big as a horse buggy, a dressing table with a looking glass, a desk for holding books, and more books, and lots of padded chairs. The chimney place had a fire screen embroidered with pink flowers I knew came from Mama's needle. Up on the mantel were two white vases, pure porcelain. I looked everything over, then stood there, wondering what to do. I said, "Sure it's cold." Miss Sarah didn't answer, so I said louder, Sure is cold. This snapped her from her wall staring. You could lay a fire, I guess. I've seen it done, but seeing ain't doing. I didn't know to check the flue, and here came all this smoke swarming out like chimney bats. Miss Sarah started throwing open windows. It must have looked like the house was burning, 'cause out in the yard, Tomfrey yelled, "Fire! Fire!" Then everybody took it up. I grabbed the basin of water in the dressing room, used for freshening up, and hurled it on the fire, which didn't do nothing but cause the smoke to double up. Miss Sarah fanned it out the windows, looking like a ghost through all the black clouds. There was a jib door in her room that opened to the piazza, and I ran to get it open, wanting to shout to Tomfrey we didn't have a fire, but before I could yank it free, I heard Mrs. flying round the house hollering for everybody to get out and take an armload. After the smoke thinned to a few floating cobwebs, I followed Miss Sarah to the yard. Old Snow and Sobby had already bridled up the horses and pulled the carriages to the back in case the whole yard went down with the house. Tomfrey had Prince and Eli toting buckets from the cistern. Some neighbor men had showed up with more buckets. Folks feared a fire worse than the devil. They kept a slave sitting all day up in the steeple on St. Michael's, watching the rooftops for fire. And I worried he'd seen all the smoke, ring the church bell, and the whole brigade show up. I ran to Mama, who was bunched with the rest of them. The stuff they thought worth saving was heaped in piles by their feet. China bowls, tea caddies, record books, clothes, portraits, Bibles, brooches, and pearls. Even a marble bust was sitting out there. Mrs. had her gold-tipped cane in one hand and a silver cigar holder in the other. Miss Sarah was trying to cut through the frantics to tell Tomfrey and the men there wasn't a fire to throw their water on. But by the time she dragged the words out her mouth, the men had gone back to hauling water. When it got worked out what had happened, Mrs. went into a fury. "Hetty, you incompetent fool!" Nobody moved, not even the neighbor men. Mama moved over and tucked me behind her, but Mrs. jerked me out front. She brought the gold-tipped cane down on the back of my head, worst blow I ever got. It drove me to my knees. Mama screamed. So did Miss Sarah. But Mrs., she raised her arm like she'd go at me again. I can't describe proper what came next. The workyard, the people in it, the walls shutting us in, all that fell away. The ground rolled out from under me, and the sky billowed off like a tent caught in the wind. I was in a space to myself, somewhere time can't cross. A voice called steady in my head, "Get up from there. Get up from there and look her in the face. Dare her to strike you. Dare her." I got on my feet and poked my face at her. My eyes said, "Hit me. I dare you." Mrs. let her arm drop and stepped back. Then the yard was round me again, and I reached up and felt my head. A lump was there the size of a quail egg. Mama reached over and touched it with her fingertip. The rest of that God-forsook day, every woman and slave girl was made to drag clothes, linens, rugs, and curtains from every room upstairs out to the piazza for airing out. Everyone but Mama and Benna showered me with looks of despising. Miss Sarah came up there, wanting to help, and started hauling with the rest of us. Every time I turned round, she was looking at me like she'd never seen me before in her life.
Sarah. I took meals alone in my room for 3 full days as a protest against owning Hetty, though I don't think anyone much noticed. On the 4th day, I swallowed my pride and arrived in the dining room for breakfast. Mother and I hadn't spoken of the doomed manumission document. I suspected she was the one who'd torn it into 2 even pieces and deposited them outside my room, thereby having the last word without uttering a syllable. At the age of 11, I owned a slave I couldn't free. The meal, the largest of the day, had long been underway. Father, Thomas, and Frederick had already left in pursuit of school and work, while Mother, Mary, Anna, and Eliza remained.
"You are late, my dear," Mother said,
not without a note of sympathy. Phoebe, who assisted Aunt Sister and looked slightly older than myself, appeared at my elbow, emanating the fresh odors of the kitchen house. Sweat, coal, smoke, and an acrid fishiness. Typically, she stood by the table and swished the fly brush, but today she slid a plate before me heaped with sausages, grit cake, salted shrimp, brown bread, and tapioca jelly. Attempting to lower a quivery cup of tea beside my plate, Phoebe deposited on top of my spoon, causing the contents to slosh onto the cloth.
"Oh, missus, I'm sorry," she cried,
whirling toward Mother. Mother blew out her breath as if all the mistakes of all the Negroes in the world rested personally upon her shoulders.
"Where is Aunt Sister? Why, for heaven's sake, are you serving?"
"She showing me how to do it."
"Well, see that you learn."
As Phoebe rushed to stand outside the door, I tried to toss her a smile.
"It's nice of you to make an appearance," Mother said.
"You are recovered?"
All eyes turned on me. Words collected in my mouth and lay there. At such moments, I used a technique in which I imagined my tongue like a slingshot. I drew it back, tighter, tighter.
"I'm fine,"
the words hurled across the table in a spray of saliva. Mary made a show of dabbing her face with a napkin. "She'll end up exactly like Mother," I thought, running a house congested with children and slaves, while
I trust you found the remains of your folly?" Mother asked.
Ah, there it was. She had confiscated my document, likely without Father knowing.
"What folly?"
Mary said. I gave Mother a pleading look.
"Nothing you need concern yourself with, Mary," she said,
and tilted her head as if she wanted to mend the rift between us. I slumped in my chair and debated taking my cause to Father and presenting him with the torn manumission document. I could think of little else for the rest of the day, but by nightfall I knew it would do no good. He deferred to Mother on all household matters, and he abhorred a tattler. My brothers never tattled, and I would do no less. Besides, I would have been an idiot to rile Mother further. I countered my disappointment by conducting vigorous talks with myself about the future.
"Anything is possible. Anything at all."
Nightly, I opened the lava box and gazed upon the silver button.
Handful. Missus said I was the worst waiting maid in Charleston. She said, "You're abysmal, Hetty, abysmal." I asked Miss Sarah what abysmal means, and she said, "Not quite up to standard." Uh-huh. I could tell from Missus' face, there's bad, there's worse, and after that comes abysmal. That first week, beside the smoke, I spilled lamp oil on the floor, leaving a slick spot, broke one of those porcelain vases, and fried a piece of Miss Sarah's red hair with a curling tong. Miss Sarah never tattled. She tugged the rug over to cover the oily place, hid the broke porcelain in a storeroom in the cellar, and cut off her singed hair with the snuffer we used to snip the candle wick. Only time Miss Sarah rang her bell for me was if Missus was headed our way. Benna and her two girls, Lucy and Phoebe, always sang out, "The cane tapping, the cane tapping." Miss Sarah's warning bell gave me some extra lead on my rope, and I took it. I would rove down the hallway to the front alcove where I could see the water in the harbor float to the ocean, and the ocean roll on till it sloshed against the sky. Nothing could hold a glory-bound picture to it. First time I saw it, my feet hopped in place, and I lifted my hand over my head and danced. That's when I got true religion. I didn't know to call it religion back then. Didn't know amen from what when.